So, Parashat Bamidbar, leading into Shavuot, I want to take a moment to dedicate this shiur. Some of you may know that today we dedicated our day of learning to the memory of an alum, Sam Fisher, Shmuel Ben David Yitzchak, who, really an amazing, amazing boy. He was in the third year of Oraita. Jesse remembers him well. He ended up at Harvard. He was the president of the Hillel at Harvard. He finished college. He was working. He got a fantastic job in New York. And he was running a triathlon for Stuka after swimming. And he collapsed, basically, and was nifter. And it's hard to describe the loss to the Jewish community, to the Jewish world, really, when you lose someone with that kind of potential leadership. It's hard to understand, you know, why I guess Hashem felt he had done what he needed to do in this world. I know that his family is still really struggling with this. His brother Jeremy, who was also an alum here a couple years later, really an amazing boy. So we wish them nechama, and our heart goes out to them. I want to dedicate tonight's learning to him. I'll just tell you just one quick thought. He was in the Boston, he went to Maimonides, he was in the Boston Youth Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra. He played the cello. And for the first couple months he was here, he was really trying to find a way to play cello. But, you know, it's hard to find a cello. So we finally found, I don't remember how he found it, a gamach or something, and he was able to get himself a cello. And I don't know if you know what a cello is. It's a massive, it's not like a guitar, like bring it along and it comes. It's a gesund, massive, you know, you could hide a body in there. And he used to take his cello out to the Chorva Square. And he would open up his case and he would play. And people would drop coins into the case. I remember once I passed him by, I thought it was a little odd. You know, I mean, didn't seem to need to raise a few shekels here and there to buy burgers. But okay. And he never talked about this. That was actually the year that our daughter got engaged. And we had an engagement party in Efrat. He invited people to come. And my wife had heard him play once, walking through the Rova. So she said to me, "You think you could get him to come and play cello at the engagement party?" I said, "Well, I mean, let's ask him." So I said, "Look, this is kind of funny, but, you know," she goes, "Oh, that'd be great, whatever it is." So, you know, "We'll pay you, right?" "No, no, you don't have to." We went through that little dance. And at the end of the evening, you know, my wife went over to him. She figured it'd be less embarrassing if it was her than it was me, to give him, like, whatever it was, a couple hundred shekels to play for the evening. He wouldn't take it, she said, insisted. So in the end, she stuck in his pocket. I only found out much, much later that he, over the course of the year, made about almost 8,000 shekels by playing cello in the Chorva Square, and subsequently gave it all to Tzedaka. He donated it to orphans and to homeless and whatever. And that was really who he was. There were really two, I think, powerful messages that I learned from him. One is Emor Ma'at V'Aser Bei, Atznei Alechati Moshem Elokecha. There's some people, they talk less, they're busy doing. And the second was, he figured out, and we put this article from the Jewish Star, which was an article he wrote at the end of the year, which I think is worth reading, give you some food for thought. He figured out how to be able to go back, to be in Harvard, but not to let this go, to hang on to it. And so I'm going to dedicate this year in his memory. It should be an ilui for his neshama. When I was in the Army, we haven't had an Army story for about 3 hours. You know, you go through a lot of different stages. You go through basic training, then you go through tank school, then you go through field tank school, then I got to sergeant's course, then I went to infantry officer's course. Of all the courses I was ever in, none of them, and I mean none of them, comes close to what was called the kakash. Of course, it's in Ishiryan. It's the second half of officer's course for tank officers. It's called, I guess, tank officer's training. It's about 4.5-5 months. It's considered one of the more difficult, if not the most difficult course in the Israeli Army. Very difficult course. You sleep about 2-3 hours a night for about 4 or 5 months. The pressure is intense. And we were dreading this course. I mean, I had heard nightmare stories about it. And the further along I was in the Army, the worse the stories got. And I was really terrified of this course. But I knew that I had to do it. Worse than going through the course is going through it twice. Some of you know that story. I fell out of the course about a week before we finished, and ended up deciding to do it all again. In the entire course, the most horrible part of that whole course in tank officer training is something called the ringo. Okay, gringo is basically a term, it's a slang, Shalom Aleichem, Erev Tov, right? Is a slang for, how do you say this in English? Lealter, to make things up as you go. There must be a word for that. Pardon? The improvise, good, okay? It's like an improvise course. And basically what they do is, you know, every other maneuver that they train you how to do, they teach you what you're supposed to do, you do a dry run, and then you do this. This one, they don't tell you what's going to be. You don't know what's coming at you. And it can be as much as an hour. It's a grueling course. It's up in with tanks. You're commanding tanks up through the mountains. And you don't know what's coming and where it's waiting, whatever. And added to that is the fact that if you don't pass this course, you don't pass the course. Like the whole course, everything, months and months of what was training. And for me, this was even worse because this was the second time I was going through this. And I'd actually failed it the last time. And here we are 4 or 5 months later. So I'm at the end of like over a year of officers training. There's like 2 weeks left. I can smell the end. I can almost imagine the bars on my shoulders. I just got to get through this course. I am absolutely terrified. And it comes my turn. You're given a, you know, you've got a platoon of tanks. And they decided that mine was going to be a mountain maneuver because each cadet's one is different. And I have no idea what's waiting for me. And there was a fellow who I once told you about. His name was Yuval Azulai. He was a legend in the Armored Corps. He was a genius. And he, for whatever reason, a bit of a sadist, he had decided to make my life a living nightmare during the entire second officer's course because he was determined for me to get through this. I had failed the first course on his watch. There was no way that I was failing the second one. So he took me under his wing. And he, there's a chair and a tank. It's called a Kise Ganan. It's like an armor-plated chair. And you sit in this chair, literally on top of the turret. And that's how you watch the cadet and you're training him or whatever. So he decided that he was going to manage my maneuver. He was going to see. It was going to have to be perfect. And I guess that he realized that I was pretty nervous. Terrified is more like it. And he said to me, basically, he leaned forward. And he whispered like in my ear. I can still hear his voice. I can still smell him. I can remember this moment like it was yesterday. He leans forward, he had this very serious voice. He leans forward, he says, Nakeh et harosh, like clean your mind, right? Tizrom, flow with it. Ata yodea ma tzarich lasot, you know what you have to do, now just do it. That's what he said. And then he leaned back and he gave the command to start. I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was about what he said. But all of a sudden, just everything left my mind. Ever have a moment like that where you're in this intense situation and you just somehow find this focus and it like glows into slow motion? That's what happened. And for the next hour, I can't even explain it. Just everything that came. In fact, I remember there was one point where they popped a bazooka. A bazooka is a guy who has like a handheld anti-tank weapon. And you're supposed to, right, so this thing pops up and it's a bazooka. And you have to turn your machine gun at him. But at the same time, there's a tank that pops up over there. You've got to direct your gunner to fire the tank. And there's a third target you've got to direct your to. They want you to do so many things at once that you lose it. And this is where I usually lost it. For some reason, it was just, you know, one hand on the machine gun, one hand on the radio, sending the it just all worked. And when the whole thing was done and the dust had settled, like I knew that I was done. Like before I even got the score. And I realized that sometimes, if you want to get it right, you have to let it go. You just have to let it go. And sometimes you can't let it go. And because you can't let it go, you can't get it right. And I thought about this, I can't even tell you how many times that, how did that work? And what went wrong the first time around? I think the first time around, I just couldn't let it all go. And the second time around, I just let it go. So what does that mean? And how do you translate that into your life? So this week, we start Sefer Bamidbar, the book of Bamidbar. Now in English, they call it Numbers, because there's a count, and that's a whole discussion. Why are we counting? But in Hebrew, based on the first pasuk, and really the first word, almost, we call it Sefer Bamidbar. Bamidbar, this is the book of in the desert. And this is actually the book, the fourth of the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the five books. This is the book where the Jewish people really transition from a motley crew into a nation. They are forged in the desert, right? And it's interesting that we read always we read this Sefer right before Shavuot. We always read the book of In the Desert right before they receive the Torah. Now, what would be the obvious reason that we read or begin reading the book of In the Desert, Bamidbar, right before we commemorate and celebrate receiving the Torah? What's the obvious reason? Because we got the Torah in the desert. We got the Torah in the desert. Oh, we're so clever. So let's read the In the Desert before Shavuot. What's the obvious question? Why do we get the Torah in the desert? And I want you to know. I mean, God has an array of choices as to where we can receive the Torah. And it's pretty much endless. I mean, you know, we could receive the Torah up on the mountain, on the Himalayas. We could be in the Everglades. There's a million places you could see the Torah. By the way, what would have been the most obvious choice of where to receive the Torah? Where? Okay, that I wasn't thinking about that because we weren't there yet, right? What's the problem with waiting until you get to Israel? You don't have Torah. No, I would have thought, get the Torah in Egypt. Like, there's 10 plagues. The firstborn are dead. I've got this, by the way, this would be covered. This would be awesome, okay? Because the firstborn are dead. The next morning we wake up, we're about to get out of Egypt. And Hashem says, I'm giving you the Torah. That would be awesome. And so we could commemorate receiving the Torah at the Seder. That'd be awesome. Think about it, a Seder with cheesecake. It'd be unbelievable, right? Be unbelievable. So we don't do that because we're not ready, because we have to receive it in the desert. That means the whole world is without Torah for 7 weeks. Why? Why do we need to receive the Torah in the desert? By the way, it's deeper than just a coincidence of having to pass through the desert. The Gemara in Darim, right, the Talmud on Daf, a new name on Aleph, 55a, says as follows, there's a discussion of the different places, the journeys in the desert. So it says, from the desert, the gift, right, which were Umi Matana Nachliel, and from Matana they went to Nachliel. And it's a play on these words, Umi Nachliel Bamot. So, Mimidbar, from the desert, Matana, what's Matana? A gift, right? What do you think the Gemara is going to do with that? And how? What are they going to say? All right, we'll see, I guess. Nachaliel, what does Nachaliel mean? An inheritance of God. What's Bamot? What's a Bama? High place. Right? Shaul meets Shmuel in the Ramah. The great rabbis put on the Bama, high place. Right? So this is what the Gemara says. Kevan she'ose adam atzmo kimidbar shehu mufkar lakol Torah nitla lo b'matana. If, because a person is willing to make himself like the desert, then he receives the gift of Torah. Which many of the commentaries explain to mean, if you want to receive Torah in your life, you got to make yourself like the desert. What does that even mean? What does that mean? So I'll share with you an idea, which I think is a powerful idea in terms of preparing for receiving Torah, but I also think it's a powerful idea in terms of preparing to move on from this year that we call Oraita, right? So, you know, we read We read on Shavuot Megillat Rut. Everybody knows we read Megillat Rut. Why do we read Megillat Rut on Shavuot? Am I remember? Pretty obvious. Pardon? Because what? Okay, because we all receive Torah in our life, and therefore, Rut, right, is the most famous, if not the first, Gioret. She is Mekabel Torah. She receives Torah in life. By the way, that's not a good enough answer, but over Shavuot, I'm sure one of us will give a shiur on this, because I could think of a lot of better things to read in Chamisha Rosh, but okay, right? And if you look at the story of what Ruth does, it's really quite amazing. I mean, she leaves everything behind. According to the Medrash, she's a Midianite princess. So that's fascinating. And we'll focus on that, and we'll talk about that, and we had a discussion about this, some of us, earlier in the shiur, the different stages, right? Vasher telchi aleich, whither you go, I will go. Vasher talini alin, where you stay, I will stay. Or where you sleep, I will sleep. Ameich ami, Eloheich Elohai, your God is my God, your people are my people. Vasher tamuti amut v'shame kaver, I will die where or how you die, I will be buried there. I'm willing to connect myself to align myself, to embrace what you represent, Judaism, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for eternity. And without getting into it, the Midrashim, there are five stages. This is a powerful discussion about what it means to accept Judaism in your life. And that's all great. And now everybody talks about it. We call it Megillat Rut, and it's all about Rut, and it's true. Great. But there's another sister. And this sister, she has almost the same path, but she ends up in a very different space. Now, what's her name? Remember? Orpah. Orpah. By the way, what does the word Orpah mean? Oref. What is Oref? Okay, Oref is the neck. Vayifen Oref is the back of the neck. Her name symbolizes the fact that she turns around. Right? Now, she's on the same journey. Right? Nomi and Rut. I'm sorry, Nomi and Elimelech, there's a famine. They go down. Should they? Shouldn't they? Whatever. And they have two sons, Machlon and Kilion. By the way, those are two strange names for sons. Kilion means decimation. Machlon is either from the word sickness or disease, right? Machala, or machul, right? So, that's, I mean, you know, sickness, do you know where your brother disease, like that's a strange, but okay. And that's what happens to them. They're gone. They're destroyed. They have no children. They're gone. And so there's these two brides, Ruth and Orpah, and they're left. And according to the Midrash, they're Midianite princesses. And they have nowhere to go. Now, they don't have nowhere to go. They're like, I don't know, Jacqueline Kennedy after Kennedy's gone. They have lots of places to go. But they don't want to leave Nomi, so they go with Nomi, who decides there's nothing left for in Midian, and they go back to the border, and then they have this whole dialogue, right? And Rut doesn't let go. But Orpah does. And if you look at the Pasuk, Vatomer hine sheva yivintech, your sister-in-law has returned. Elama, to her people. V'el Eloheha, and to her gods. Shuvi achrei vintech, follow her, says Nomi to Rut. And then Rut gives that whole dialogue, that whole soliloquy, and in the end, Rut stays, and Orpah leaves. And the Medrash, right, the Medrash in Medrash Rabbah, Rut Rabbah, says very clearly, because she returned to her people, she returned to her gods. Now the Medrash implies that if you go back to Midian, you're going to become a Midianite. So, that's a fascinating question. First of all, why do we have to assume that if Orpah goes back to Midian, she's going to embrace the Midianite way? And how is it that she, like, I mean, we could debate this topic. If Orpah had just left and gone back, then I'm not sure we would call it a failure. But if Orpah goes back to her gods, then that's a failure. She's sunken back into the morass of idolatry. So why does Ruth succeed? And more interestingly enough, why does Orpah fail? And of course, there's a hidden question here. When you go out there and you have that crossroads in your life, how do you know you're going to succeed and you're not going to fail? Is there a simple recipe? Because that's where we're headed. You know? We're going to have an amazing, amazing 2 days of learning on Sunday, Monday. It's our last 2 days to rock the base matters. And then we're going to have Shavuot. And for those of you who've never tasted what Shavuot is in Yerushalayim, you're in for, it's an amazing experience. Shavuot night on Arai, it's an amazing experience. And then we're going to go up to the Galil. And then we're going to spend Shabbat in Tzfat, and that's a mind-blowing experience. And then we're going to come back, and Sunday is probably the most intense day of the entire year. It's really an unbelievable day. There are no words to describe these experiences, and they're all packed into. It's probably the most amazing week of the entire year. And then you get to Monday morning, Monday afternoon, whenever it'll be. And the Beis Midrash gets empty. And I got to tell you, I have a hard time coming. I don't come in that Monday morning. I can't bear walking in the Beis Midrash. I just like it so empty. And you know, for you, it's like the memories of, you know, what you had here. They'll be here forever. Ask Alex. He walks in here. And he, you know, you're all looking at you sitting here. And he's probably seeing who sat there and who sat here and where did I sit. And I remember exactly where you sat. And for me, there's 10 years worth of memories in this Beis Midrash. I remember the first year of Oraita when that was the dining room. And there were like 20 guys here. And on a good night, there were 15. Like, you could all fit right here. And the basement is faced this way. And on and on. And you go. So you got to let go. Do you let go? How do you know that it sticks with you? What can you do about that? So there's another interesting story. What does this remind you of? Two individuals, and they can go either way. And one of them sticks with it, and the other one goes in a totally different direction. And they end up in two totally different places. Pardon? No, Yaakov and Esav are never at a crossroads. Yaakov and Esav, in fact, it's the opposite. Yaakov and Esav grow up. Shnei goyim bevitneich. You're two separate. These are two people who seem to be on the same path, and yet they really weren't. And the only way we know they weren't is because of the results, yeah? Pardon? Lot and Avraham. Interestingly, Rut is a Moaviah. How was Moav born? Moav is born of Lot. It's the same family tree. Right? Lot leaves Sodom, incest, his two daughters. He has two sons, they sleep with him, they think that the world is over, they want to give birth to it again, whatever. And there are two nations that are born of that incest, and one of them is called Moab. And Lot basically leaves. And the ultimate question is, does Lot ever return? Well, Lot returns when Ruth comes back. So it's the same scenario, only it's different. So what's the scenario of Lot? Right? So you remember the story, right? There were shepherds of Lot. Right, Reeve ben Roy Mikne Lot to ben Roy Mikne Avraham, the shepherds of Lot, the shepherds of Avraham, they get into some ethical moral debate. It's not really between Avraham and Lot, it's between their shepherds. And Avraham calls Lot in for a powwow. And he says, Al na tehi miriva ben yu veinecha. Let us not be in conflict. You can't have a fight with someone unless there are two of you fighting. If you refuse to be in a state of conflict, then you won't have a conflict. That's a dangerous thing to say. Because sometimes you have to be in a state of conflict, right? Deciding we're not going to be at war with, I don't know, Iran doesn't mean we're not going to be at war with Iran. But to turn something into an argument between two people needs to be two of us. Okay. So put aside for the moment what Avram is doing and what he hopes Lot will say and what Lot does. What does Lot do, right? What does it say? By Ashkefa Pnekikar, Lot looks out, right? Avram says, "Hello, kol ha'aretz lefanecha. The whole land is before you. The whole world is before you. He pared na me'alai, separate from me. Ima smol ve'emin avim ha'emin ve'esnila. Obviously, we're in different spaces. So you go your way, and I'll go mine. You pick. Now, by the way, what does Avram hope that Lot will say? What do you think? I mean, remember, Yitzchak isn't born yet. This is Lishmael isn't born. This is Avram's heir." This is his family. He doesn't have any other family. This is his future. I got to imagine that Avram is hoping Lot will say, what are you talking about? I love you. We'll work this out. But what does Lot do? Vayisa Lot et einav. Vayar et kol kikar yarden ki kula mashkeh. He sees the fertile valley of Sodom. Vayivchal Lot et kol kikar yarden. So Lot chooses the lush valley of Sodom. He's on the mountain. He's in the high place, probably in Harei Chevron. One day it says he's in Beth El. And he heads down more than just literally. And the pasuk says, Vayisa Lot Mikedem. What does that mean? Yama Vakedma Tzafona Venegba. What's Kedma? What's Yama? To the west, east. Water, right? Yam, west. Right? What's Kedma?
East.
What's the problem here, by the way? Think about the map. If he's on the mountain range, and he's looking down at the valley of Sodom, which way is he facing? Okay, think about the map. Here's the map. Here's the Golan. Here's the Negev. Here's the mountain range in the middle. And here's, right? Am I getting this right? No. And here's the Jordan Valley. Right? Which way is Jordan from us?
East.
So he's looking eastwards. So what does it mean, Vayisal Lot Mikedem? That Lot travels from the east. He's not traveling from the east, he's traveling eastwards. Makes no sense. So Rashi senses this, and he comes up with a kakamim, the Sifti Chachamim. Well, really, he's standing on this side of Avram, so he goes around Avram, so he's going to the east of Avram. It just doesn't make sense. And the Mizrahi points this out. Mizrahi points out this makes no sense, right? In the Sifti Chachamim, he says, Kotavareim, Rav Elez Mizrahi, the Jordan Valley is in the east. Right? And so on and so forth. Which is why Rashi says, that's not what we're talking about here. He see atzmo mikadmono shel olam. He didn't just leave Avram. He left the source of the universe. Vayisalot mikedem. He left the origins of it all. And you got to ask yourself the same question. Lot, I mean, he leaves Mesopotamia. He's on the journey with Avram. He goes down to Egypt. He comes back with Avram. They were so close. How do you live in the world of Avraham and then leave? How does a person fall off the map? And this is not just, you know, a mystical question. This is a practical, existential question. Wherever you go in life, unfortunately, maybe you'll be the lucky ones. You're going to encounter this. You're going to meet the guy who started out on the first day of college. And I'm using stereotypes here, which aren't really the point, but just to make the point. You know, the guy who's at Minyan every day and he's got his tzitzis out and he loves davening. And he can't wait till Friday night because he loves Shabbos. And then you run into him, maybe he's third year, maybe he's fourth year, and it's all gone. How's that happen? And most frightening of all, how do I know it won't happen to me? I remember struggling with this question in the army. I had a chavrusa who I learned with in Gush, and he spent months trying to convince me not to go to officer's course. And you got to understand, if I wouldn't have gone to officer's course, I would have been back in yeshiva. Like, I was technically done with what I had to do as a volunteer, you know, I was pretty much done. I would have just been in yeshiva. Instead, I was going to go and spend a couple more years in the army, whatever it was. And back then, it isn't like today. Today, I've heard that you go to Barachat, it's like yeshiva, like Shabbos there, it's like, you know, there's 100 religious guys. In my day, I mean, my second course, I was the only guy with a keep on my whole pluga. There was nothing going on. I had no one to learn with. I had no minion for months. He said to me, you're going to lose it all. You're going to lose it all. You're talking about maybe going into education. You're going to lose it all. He said, you have no right to take that. I remember he said this to me. He wanted to guilt me. He said, you have no right to take that away from the Jewish people. You go on officers because you think it's cool. Like, the Jewish people need, they don't need another officer. They need, that was his opinion. And he starked me, and he said, why don't you ask Rav Lichtenstein, why don't you ask him? And we had this running debate. And he said to me, before I left, he said, I want you to know, in 6 months, you're not religious anymore. That's what he thought. Now, it took me a while to realize, he was an older, he was like Shana Hay. It took me a while to realize what he was doing. I think what he did was, he set up a scenario where I was going to prove him wrong. I'm not sure he really believed that, and I spent a lot of time when I was in office course doing all sorts of things to prove him wrong, so I could come back and say, I told you so, which I think was his point, right? So that's a separate discussion. But I was really nervous about that. How do you know you don't lose it all? You know, this isn't like, and just to be clear, like, I think going for a college education is an amazing thing to do. And I think a secular college education can broaden your horizons and bring so much into your life. But how do you ensure that you don't pay that price? Because I want you to know, like, I'm thrilled that my kids are heading to get a secular education. My daughter's in medical school. My you know, Yonatan is heading to study communications now. And that's great. But if you told me, if I could absolutely know, chas v'shalom, that one of my kids was going to completely dump Judaism or get a college degree, I'd give up the college degree in a second. That's not worth giving it all. So how do you know? So there's a detail here in this story, which I think is a clue. And that's the story of Sdom. If you look at the story of Sdom, there's a detail in there. Fascinating detail. Shem sends the malachim, they're going to destroy Sdom. One of them comes, whatever a malach is, and he says, you got to get out of Sdom. Remember this story? You got to get out of Sdom. And, you know, Lot is more Sdomite than the Sdomites. I mean, when they come into the city, it says, V'lot Yoshev Bashar Sdom. He's sitting in the gate. The Gemara says, the people who sat in the gate, those are who sits in the gates, remember?
Judges.
The judges. He's a leader in the community. He's got son-in-laws who are Sdomites.
the Stomites have some issue on. They're like maybe the Nazis who find the Jewish. So he stands outside the door and he's holding them off, which means he has a standing. And then things go from bad to worse. They're going to shecht him, they're going to shecht his son-in-law, whatever's going on. So finally, they have to grab his arm. Ukumo ha-shachar ala, dawn is coming. V'ya'itzu ha-malachim b'lot. So they're hurrying him and they're saying, Kum kachat ishtecha v'chtev notecha. It's time to go. You're going to get caught up. What's the next pasuk? What's the next word? There are only five instances in the entire Torah we find this tam mikra, called a shalshelet. Right? A shalshelet is this three-way squiggly line. Okay? Where else do I find the shalshelet? I find it by Yosef. Right? Vayimain. Yosef refuses to sleep with Potiphar's wife, but the tam there is a shalshelet. Vayimain. Like, almost as though to convey that Yosef was struggling. It wasn't just so easy to resist the wiles of Potiphar's wife. She was a beautiful woman. And he was all alone. And he was handsome. And who would know? And anyway, everybody abandoned him. So he struggled with this. And that is a turning point in Yosef's life. And there are many instances of this. When Eliezer goes down and he struggles with the mission to pick a wife for Yitzchak, perhaps because he's hoping that his daughter would be the inheritor of Avram's house. So what's going on here? Vayit mahama. And so he hesitates. Why does he hesitate? And why is that shalshelet? Why do we sing that word with that tune? Because Lot is struggling with who I am. He's struggling. And what does that mean? What's he struggling with? What's he having a hard time doing? Letting it go. Lot is living in the tent of Avram, but his head is in stone. And he's having a hard time getting out of stone, because his head is still in stone. Lot takes a different path, because Lot never really left. In fact, if you look at the Psukim, Lot never really left Mesopotamia. Lot goes down to Egypt, right? And comes back up from Egypt. Look at the order of the verse. Look at where Lot fits. There's Avram, there's Sarah, there's Lot, and there's the cattle. But when they come back up, Lot's in a different place in the order. Something happens to Lot in Egypt during the famine. He has a hard time leaving Egypt. And so his head is in stone, and he has a hard time leaving head in stone. You know, there's an amazing example of this. There's a Mishnah in Kalim, okay? Mishnah in Kalim, which is all about, you know, different things that are tmeim and not tmeim, what's impure, what's not pure. Right? If something's connected to life, for example, a tree can't become tummy. Right? What is tuma? Impurity. What is tuma? Tuma is contact with death. That's basically what impurity is all about. So if something is living, it can't become tummy. What's the ultimate tuma? The avi avoto tuma, dead body. So if a person's alive, he's the essence, or she's the essence of tuma. So that's a whole interesting question. So if something's growing in the ground, it can't become tummy. There's a whole discussion in the Mishnah and Oktzin if a branch gets broken, but the sap is still coming down. Is it tamei? So this particular Mishnah is talking about animals. If I make a vessel from animal skin, so the vessel can become tamei. Okay? But Mishnah Yigimel, this is Perek Yitzayin, Mishnah Yigimel 17:13 in the Mishnah in Kalim. Kalim is in Tarot. Where would I find the halachos of Kalim, by the way? In the Rambam? Sefer? Tara. There you go. The 10th book, right? Okay. Kol Shebayam Tahor. Any fish, any animal that lives in the sea is pure. Chutz mikelev hamayim. Except for the water dog, which is probably a seal. A seal or a sea lion. A seal can become tamei, even though, now, and obviously if a fish lives in the sea, so its environment is water, and water is purity, so it can't become tamei, can't become impure. And if you take a fish skin and you make a vessel, that vessel cannot become impure. Except for a sea lion. Why? Because it runs to hide on land. That's what Rebbe Akiva says. A sea lion, even though its home is in the sea, it constantly runs to the land. So the Bartanura, Vadya Bartanura, he was one of the great commentators, 16th century from Italy. By the way, he came to Israel and he's buried here, right near Ir David, right? Because No fish runs up on the land to hide from things that are hunting it. Ela kelev hayam, except for the sea lion. Hilchach havei bichlal ro'ot ha'yabashah. Therefore, it's considered to be of the land, right? And so on and so forth, right? It's mekabel tumah v'alach k'Rabbi Akiva. That's how we pass it. And the Tiferet Yisrael of the Jin Rebbe in the Yachin, he says like this: Kayatua mimin dag. Okay, Midiyesh kama minei dagim shemugalim lalot leyabashah. But there are certain sea animals that do come up on the land. Kayatua mimin dag anikra ael, which I think is an eel. There are certain types of eels. They'll slither up from the sea and they'll go into the wheat fields and they'll eat, right? Near the river. And they crawl up there on their fins or whatever they have. So that they can satisfy their hunger. But nonetheless, even though an animal sometimes goes up on the land to eat, that doesn't make it susceptible to tuma, right? Why? Right? Only when an animal is hunted, right? And in being hunted, it runs, right? Nirdaf. Because in that instance, you see that really its place of sanctuary is the earth, is the land, not the sea. And the Tzidkas HaTzadik, Rav Tzadik, and we're almost done, Tzidkas HaTzadik says, this is a powerful idea, El makom she'adam boreach be'et tzarato, misham nikar shehu shorsho. Look at where a person runs to when he's having a tough time. That's where his root is. That's where his source is. So the sea lion, when it's being hunted, it runs to the land. That means that really, its sanctuary, its home, is the earth, is the land. It's not really a full sea animal. Right? Now think about this. So if a person runs to Torah, even if that's not what he does all day. Now think about this for a minute. Lot is in a moment of tzara. He's struggling. And he runs to Sdom. And what that means is that Sdom is where he really is. Opa is with Naomi. She's followed that whole path. But as soon as things get tough, she demonstrates that her heart is really in Midian. So that's where she goes. So I think maybe the question is not physically where you're at. The question is, where's your home? Where's your root? Where's your source? You know, if you have a tough day and you need a break, and what you do naturally is turn on TV, then what that means is that your shoresh is in television. If you're having a tough day, you just need a break, and you pick up a Rambam, obviously, what else would you pick up? Then your shoresh is in Rambam, it's in Torah. And you get to decide where your root is. You ask me, one of the most powerful things that happens to us here in Israel is we get to rethink our priorities. Where are we really? To where do we run? Where's our place of sanctuary? And if you're in the Beis Medrash all day, but really your sanctuary, your ratzon, is in the movies, then really you're in the movies. But if you're working out in the field all day, you're in college, you're taking courses, but your shoresh is the Beis Medrash, even if you only get there an hour a week, an hour a day, if that's where your heart is, then that's where you are. And that's how you change the paradigm. It's about, where do I really want to be? You know? It's about setting red lines. And I'll tell you one last thing, because it's getting late. We just celebrated Yom Yerushalayim. It's an unbelievable thing. 50 years. I want you to know, watching you guys dance down that was unbelievable. And then you get out there, and you look up that street, Agron, and they close the street, and as far as you can see, just people with flags, and dancing and singing, you know? And I got to talk to a few alumni and a couple of friends. I have a brother-in-law who lives. And what is Yom Yerushalayim in America? I remember when I was there for 3 years. If you were lucky, they had something going on in the show. They broke out some falafel, and they got someone to play some Israeli songs.
And I'm not at all being cynical about what you can do with Yom Yerushalayim in America. You're not in Yerushalayim. Of course it's different. What a different feeling. How did we get the privilege of celebrating Yom Yerushalayim? How did we merit to be home after 50 years and thousands of years? So people will say, because in 1967 the Israeli paratroopers came in, that's true, on the wings of eagles. And people will say, David Ben-Gurion and Theodore Herzl, we built the state of Israel. And that's true too. They were Achav in the saddle of the chariot fighting for Am Yisrael. That's all true. But you want to know where it really came from? It came because for 2,000 years, wherever the Jewish people were, in our hearts we knew this was home. We may have been elsewhere. We may have been only able to dream, but this was our Makom Bricha. This is where we longed to be. As long as you long to be here, then you'll be okay wherever you go. When you have no more longing to be here, that's when you got to get here. You know, that's the challenge that awaits all of us in different ways. You know, we'll walk out of the Beis Medrash every day. And that's okay to walk out of the Beis Medrash. Do I miss it? Do I long to be there? You know? In so many different ways, that's the challenge of Bamidbar. So why do we receive the Torah in the desert? Because the desert is the place where I can put everything aside. Where I can have that Ringo moment of clarity. Nobody owns the land in the desert. You don't go to the desert to be in the desert. People go through the desert. The desert is the place where you can put everything aside. You can let the things go that are holding you back and refocus on where you really want to be. And that's the challenge of Sefer Bamidbar. So Hashem should bless us all, Bezrat Hashem, that we succeed in hanging on to our priorities, in figuring out who we really are and who we want to be, and finding ways to hang on to that, because that's a good thing to hang on to. And we should all have an awesome, awesome Shabbat, an amazing Shavuot, before we go even higher up the Tzfat. We're in for a treat. Shabbat Shalom.